Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The reality we live in can be a very strange place. Most of the time, fact being stranger than fiction. How will we ever start to understand this reality we live in unless we question everything? Join me and a guest as we unravel the mysteries of this reality, one topic at a time. This is Icarus, the Reality with Shane Jones.
What is up, inquirers, and welcome to the expanse of deep open-minded conversation. I'm the one they call Shane, and today marks the very first episode of Season 3 of Inquiries of Our Reality. That's right, guys. Inquiries of Our Reality is officially 2 years old. It's been a long, rewarding journey, and I wouldn't have made it this far without all of you guys. Thank you guys so much for continuing to support the show and what I do and be the best community of people I've ever had the privilege of meeting. I have no idea what the future might have in store for the show, but I'm excited to see where it goes. Till then, I'll be here, plugging along and enjoying every minute of it. And as far as today's episode goes, considering that it is the mark and first episode of Season 3, I thought it'd be appropriate to bring on a heavy hitter as far as research goes into the Fortean weird topics and anomalous events. So today's guest is definitely going to fulfill your need for hearing about weird, bizarre locations and anomalous events. Heavy hitter, absolutely fantastic. I found the guy on Tony Merkel's show, actually, and after hearing his conversation, I really thought I had to bring him on for a conversation. But before we get into this fascinating Season 3 opener, first, we of course have to do the front of house stuff. So guys, don't forget to go and follow Inquiries of All Reality and Open Minds Media on Instagram and on Facebook, or across any other social media you happen to find me on. And for video content, don't forget to follow Open Minds Media on YouTube and on TikTok. And if you guys want to join the discussion, you guys can become a member of the Open Minds Media Discord and pop in with a lot of the fantastic people who I've met along the path of doing this podcast, of course, and all of their fun, quirky ideas, theories, and all the other stuff that gets involved with a community of fantastic people. And if you guys have an encounter report, you guys can report that to OMMencounterreports@outlook.com. I do want to do a lot more with those. And even if it's a short one, I can compile it all together and make a episode where it's a compilation of a bunch of your guys' experiences. But the only way that'll happen, of course, is with your guys' help and you guys sending me those encounters. And you guys can also check out my other show, Bizarre Encounters, which I do with my fantastic co-host, Oren, over there. A little bit different than the format of this show as far as it's a lot of our deep dives. We've got a lot of awesome stuff in the works over there, so highly recommend going and checking out if you guys haven't already. And if you guys want to submit questions for Bizarre Inquiries, which is our side show that we do, we would absolutely love to discuss them and let our minds wander off of your questions. We got a couple on retainer that we're definitely going to hit, so don't think we forgot about you guys, but just keep submitting those questions, of course. We got more stuff to do as far as Bizarre Inquiries goes. And if you guys want to support the show, the best way to do so is through Patreon. There are multiple tiers over there you guys can select from. There is a free trial for the $3 and the $5 tier. So if you guys want to see what it's all about before you guys completely sign up, that is always definitely an option. And you'll get things over there such as early access to the show, lives of the show, live replays of the show, exclusive giveaways, exclusive merch store discounts, and a plethora of other things, of course. And you guys can also, to support the show, go and check out the OMM merch store. Over there, I don't just have stuff for Inquiries, Bizarre Encounters, and for Bizarre Inquiries, but I also have a bunch of other designs that I've worked on that aren't necessarily podcast design logos. They're like their own standalone things pertaining to cryptids, paranormal, all that fun stuff, of course. And if you guys want to use code CRYPTID10, you guys can get 10% off over there. Definitely make sure you guys use that before that gets removed. I'll probably keep that running at least till the end of April. Then after that, that code will be gone, and there might be a new one that pops up in the next couple months past that. And if anybody's interested in podcast production services, you guys can shoot me a message through Open Minds Media. Offer a full list of different things that I can offer, whether you're just starting off a podcast or you have a podcast and want to make it easier on yourself. Shoot me a message. Let's figure something out. And you guys will be helping me with my financial situation, which I greatly appreciate. And of course, I have to give a shout out to all of the fantastic people that I've met in the community who have decided to sponsor the show. So guys, don't forget to go and check out I Know Squatch for all of your squatchy gear needs. You guys can also check out Cryptoteology for all of your wearable cryptid favorites. And then you guys can also check out Snarly Yao if you guys have beards, you guys like all of the fantastic natural body products. He offers a line of body wash, body/beard soap, beard oil, beard balm, all of that with a smoky cedar smell with a hint of mint. Absolutely fantastic. And if you guys are somewhat near the West Virginia area, I highly recommend you guys go and check out Snarly Yao on Instagram and Facebook, see what events he's putting on, because he does throw a bunch of different events. And he's one of the best people as far as the community goes. He's the most kind, one of the most kind people I've ever had the privilege of meeting. So he brings a lot of fantastic people around him. And all of his events are family friendly, so you guys can even bring your little ones to those, and I guarantee you they'll have fun. Even if they're not necessarily into the cryptid stuff, just being able to be around just an awesome group of people and seeing everybody's costumes and stuff they dress up in and all the cool stuff that they offer at their tables and everything. And moving into the affiliate links, you guys can go and check out Organite for all of your spiritual energy needs. And that is a relatively new sponsor, so you guys can go down to the show description, see what kind of awesome things he creates. They're pyramids that pertain to taking in negative energy and putting out positive energy. Very cool. The guy works on them all himself, and he is also one of the nicest people I've met in the community. And you guys can use code OMM for 10% off of your purchase, so don't forget to use that, of course, and use the affiliate link to make sure that it gets marked that you guys are coming over and checking that out from my end. And to all my paranormal investigators out there, don't forget to go and check out the Chattergeist. It is the all-in-one paranormal investigating device. I use it every single time I go out. It's my absolute favorite, and there's a lot of new updates and modifications that he's been working on as far as the Chattergeist goes. So if you guys want to go and check that out, you guys can always go on to Instagram, check out Dimension Devices. Barry is the guy who runs that page, and he's also the guy who programmed and developed the Chattergeist. So if you guys have any technical questions whatsoever, he'll be able to answer all of those for you. And if you guys decide to pick up a Chattergeist for yourself, don't forget to use the affiliate link. It goes back towards helping out the show, and I greatly, greatly appreciate it. And every single thing that I mentioned is all available in the link tree, which is available down in the show description. And with that, let's get into the show. Please welcome to the show, author, researcher, and lecturer, Trey Hudson. How's it going today?
It's great. You know, if I got any better, I'd spontaneously combust and somebody would have to write a chapter about that.
I was going to say, I'm sure there's enough books written about that. I remember hearing an episode of another podcast not too long ago, just talking about a bunch of spontaneous combustion experiences. That's one of those ones. It's like, where do you even start with trying to dig that apart and try to figure out how exactly that happens?
So yeah, everything's great. Life is good. You had a few sad moments with my team, you know, last month, and we're, you know, trying to get over that, but you know, life goes on. And, it's all going pretty well.
Say, if you want to dive into that at some point, I mean, you're more than welcome to. If not, we can completely leave it out, but I guess a good spot to start for anybody that may not be familiar with you, your work, your books, anything that you're doing, just to give people kind of a rough idea about who you are, what you do, and what exactly your team works on.
A little bit about me. I've been, you know, interested in this kind of stuff, you know, ever since the 70s. I grew up watching In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy and Project UFO and, you know, really cool, you know, semi-documentaries like, you know, Sasquatch or The Legend of Bigfoot. You know, that's a great 70s film if you ever want to watch it. I went to work for the federal government. I was originally a U.S. Army intelligence officer and right at the end of the Cold War. And I did that stuff for a little while and then jumped over to civil service into Department of Defense. And I did that up until last May, doing intelligence, counterintelligence, physical security, security of weapons of mass destruction, anti-terrorism. Did a stint in Afghanistan as an operations and anti-terrorism officer, you know, and protection of classified assets, material information, that kind of stuff. And it's not as cool as it sounds. It's basically a lot of administrative paperwork stuff. And so I retired as the chief of intelligence and security out of one of our DOD's industrial or organic industrial facilities. The Department of Defense has like these huge factories that are like owned by DOD. So I retired from one of those. And so now I get to do my actual vocation. You know, I tell people that was my J-O-B. That's what paid the bills. You know, that's what, you know, put my daughter through nursing school. Now, this is my vocation is researching, writing, and sharing, you know, this. It's not my story. It's this amazing story and sharing it with the rest of the world. So thank you very much for having me here tonight. And so I can share some of these just absolutely amazing experiences with you and your audience.
So I would absolutely love to dive into them. I just wanted to first say, of course, to thank you for your service, even though you said you didn't really do much active stuff and it was mainly just office stuff, but still all the same. You know, that's an awesome commitment that you're able to stay with it, not past the 4 years, but you're able to run through all the way till you're retired. So just thank you for your service. And diving into some of your other stuff too, before we get too heavy into all of your research, just out of curiosity, what kind of like sparked you getting into wanting to investigate in the first place? Other than just like watching the shows and stuff, did you have like anything that kind of happened throughout like being in the military or anything that kind of sparked your interest into actually like physically investigating yourself?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, a lot of people, you know, that are in this business, and I'll tell you, I started off as a paranormal researcher, a ghost guy. You know, that was kind of, you know, where I came from. And I studied at the University of West Georgia, and I'm actually wearing my West Georgia pullover here. Go Wolves. And they have a very interesting psychology department. It's focused mainly on humanistic and transpersonal psychology, but on staff, on faculty while I was there, one of the professors was the world famous parapsychologist, Dr. William Roll, Bill Roll. And so I had a chance to study under him. So it was just a really cool time, you know, to just be immersed in this stuff. And I popped out of the university system, you know, went into the Army Reserves. I got injured very early in my career, so I'm a disabled veteran now. Jumped back into civil service, and life got in the way of living. You know, living with the small L got more important than living with the large L, you know. And so I kind of got away from this stuff. I always had kind of an interest in it. And, you know, when the ghost shows came out, you know, in the mid-2000s, a local paranormal group started, and just kind of on a whim, I said, hey, you know, this is kind of my background. This is where I come from. Do you need any help? And so I ended up taking that organization over, and it has since morphed from the Oxford Paranormal Society into the Anomalous Studies and Observation Group. And we're a bit more holistic in the way we look at strange phenomena, that we're not just a ghost organization. Wherever the strange phenomena takes us, that's where we go, you know, and we bring best practices from different fields, be it ufology, cryptology, paranormal. We bring best practices and apply them to the situation at hand with some pretty amazing results. So that's kind of how I got into it. Our philosophy at ASOG, Anomalous Studies and Observation Group, is, you know, we very much value the empirical. You know, we go out there with Geiger counters, night vision cameras, thermals, you know, voice recorders, parabolic microphones, you know, all the gear that you would expect, trying to capture empirical data, which we have. But just as important as the empirical data is the experiential nature of the thing, is we have human beings having experiences. And if you take the human factor out of it, then the empirical really has no value if it doesn't mean anything to human beings. So we place a lot of value on the experiential. So much so is on my staff, I have people like scientists, you know, people with degrees from places like the, you know, Georgia Institute of Technology and, you know, those, you know, and hard science people. But I also have a psychotherapist on my staff. So we can also dig into the experiential. So we try to keep a foot in both camps. So I've got friends, you know, in the community on both sides. I've got friends in the, you know, the hard science world. And I was just talking with a friend of mine a couple of weeks ago, who's, I'm not going to mention his name, but y'all would recognize him. And then I was also talking to somebody else about the woo factor, you know, all the wooey weird stuff that goes on. And so we, you know, we try to, you know, just let the experience happen, you know, let it happen, try to record while we can and enjoy it as a human being.
I can definitely say I appreciate the way that you do your work, because with a lot of stuff, it seems like the kind of, the paranormal will stay to the paranormal, the ufologists will stay with the ufologists, the cryptozoologists will kind of stay together too, but it seems like we're kind of getting to a point now where everybody's starting to kind of blend things, and through blending that, you seem like you get like a lot better research, and we actually start realizing that a lot of these things overlay each other, and they're not actually separate phenomenon, and also just having people that have a scientific background as far as your research goes. Like, of course, you know, I like to dive into all the fantastical, weird, off the wall stuff, but at the same time though, it's still like you want to be open-minded but be a healthy skeptic at the same time, because you know, every bump in the night, for example, you don't want to instantly believe it's a ghost. You want to look at it rationally to actually be able to get somewhere with the research. So I have a lot of respect for people that do their research in the manner that you do, where you're not just going around saying everything's a ghost, but you're actually looking at it from multiple angles, because I feel like in the end, honestly, that's going to be the best way that we really make a discovery as far as all of this type of stuff goes, and actually start making it its own permanent place within in science and not just in like the woo-woo community, so to speak, and they'll actually start taking a lot of this stuff seriously, especially like the weird phenomenons and the paranormal aspect of it.
Yeah, that, you know, that's true. And you know what I tell people, and I had this discussion with somebody a few weeks ago working on another project. You know, I said, your belief system, you know, what I tell you, you know, what my team tells you, what this stack of affidavits tells you, what you believe on that, that's your belief system. I am not responsible for the establishment, the maintenance, or the termination of your belief system. That's on you. All I'm doing is telling you my story, and take from it what you will. And so, you know, that kind of takes me out of having a whole lot of emotional ties to what I am putting out there. You know, people are free to believe it or not. They're free to say it's a bunch of BS or it's the most amazing thing they've ever seen in their lives. It's just my story and the story of my team. And, you know, I hope people take it with the, you know, with that kind of attitude and the spirit in which it's given. And that's very freeing. That's very liberating when you stop worrying about what others say and you just enjoy the experience. You just enjoy the journey. You know, you just enjoy being there with your comrades and friends as you're going through this amazing, you know, stage in our lives.
So I guess a good spot to start, of course, before we really start diving into some of the research, because we've already kind of hinted at it, and I'm sure people are already fascinated and are starting to kind of want to get move towards that area of your stuff. But just out of curiosity, I know that a lot of your research takes place in one specific location, but assumably there's probably a story that led up to that location being found in the first place, be it somebody that had an experience or you guys even investigating something else and coming across it on accident. But where did you end up stumbling on this specific location that you call the meadow?
Yeah, that's great. Actually, kind of like, you know, what you just described is we, you know, being a ghost guy, is the Oxford Paranormal Society was a, you know, typical, this sounds weird, but a typical bread and butter ghost group. You know, we would go into places that were supposedly haunted, you know, and we'd set up all of our equipment and, you know, do EVPs and instrumental transcommunication and all of that stuff. And we started kind of running out of places to go to. You know, we weren't getting a lot of referrals anymore. And so I started looking at places that were outside. You know, we were all very comfortable, you know, in a building, you know, in a business, in a warehouse, but actually get out in the environment, which, you know, adds a whole nother level of difficulty to doing this kind of research when you're actually out in the environment and at the mercy of the weather and things like that. So I started digging into folklore. In the first few chapters of my book, I really dig into the folklore of this area, which is incredibly rich. It's really rich all the way back from like First Nations, you know, Native American stuff, all the way forward to stuff in the 21st century. You can go into the National UFO Reporting Center. This area has a lot of UFO reports. You can go into BFRO, Bigfoot Research Organization's database, a lot of Bigfoot sightings. So there's a lot of folklore here. But what really brought me to it was there was the folklore of a haunted road. you know, it's one of those places where the locals say, don't go down that haunted road or them haints will get you. You know, they'll grab you and take you out there in the holler. You know, so when a local says, don't go down that haunted road, hey, dude, that's where I'm going.
Same
I'm
here.
So, you know, I found some friends that I'd met earlier. One of them was a guy pretty well known in the Bigfoot community. Is Bob Grumpy Wilson, who some of y'all might know from the show Bigfoot is Real, and God bless him, he passed away last month. So Bob, you know, howdy if you're up there listening. And so Bob and his research partner, Daryl, we all met and set up a campsite at a base camp, and Daryl and I headed out to this haunted road. Well, nothing happened in the haunted road. Now, kind of our hypothesis was, you know, maybe it was a cryptid, you know, instead of ghost, and that's why people were confusing the two. But back at base camp, Bob had an amazing UFO sighting, which is really interesting because we had the exact same sighting several years later. And not too far from base camp, probably about a half a mile, three quarters of a mile, was a meadow. And what I want people to imagine, I'm going to paint a picture in their minds, is a beautiful mountain meadow somewhere here in the south. You know, green, lush, you know, just beautiful, just with a small river running next to it. You know, just absolutely a gorgeous place, just beautiful. And we thought, well, you know, okay, well, let's just kind of start researching around here because this seems to be just kind of where things are happening. So we started focusing on this meadow, this field, for several reasons. Number one, it's a big open area, so it created a natural track trap if something moved across it. Number two, we could set up teams in this field at night with night vision and thermal. Something moved across this big open expanse, we could see it with our equipment. Number three is there was a ridge to the north of it ridge to the south of it that we could put teams up and they could look down onto it. And the fourth thing is it had a big expanse of open sky because there were plenty of UFO sightings in this area. So it was just a good place to research. Logistically, it made sense. And the cool thing is it just happened to be one of those geo-concentrations of high strangeness that, you know, after a while become legendary.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
And we are back, so let's hop right in. Just out of curiosity, you mentioned that these stories for this place go back to like the First Nations. I'm always absolutely fascinated at some of the First Nation stories. Were they reporting like UFO or like paranormal stuff, or what exactly were the stories coming from this place from the past?
Stories coming out of there are old Cherokee legends, you know, like there are legends, and I'm not even going to try to pronounce be disrespectful and butcher their language, but the English translation is there was a entity called the Spearfinger Witch.
Oh.
And you're nodding like you've heard of the Spearfinger Witch.
I've dug into this one a few times, actually, because my grandma's 100% Cherokee, so I grew up hearing a lot of these stories. So
you know, the Spearfingered Witch is kind of like the East Coast version of the Skinwalker. You know, she's really bad news. You know, she would eat babies and eat people's livers and call them at night. And, you know, and she was enemies with, I can't remember if it was the Stonecoat Giant. There was another Bigfoot or large, you know, large giant effigy that she would, was an enemy with. And so, you know, you had these like really weird legends, you know, going all the way back, you know, to the Native Americans, which is really interesting because, my family is Celtic, you know, from Scotland, you know, in that part of the world. So, you know, you go back to that part of the world, and then you've got like, you know, Willow of the Wisp, the Fae, you know, very similar, you know, type folklore. And Josh Cutchin really goes into this in some of his writings about the folklore of, you know, high strangeness. And so, you know, it's just a really rich, rich tapestry of history. Even going as far as, you know, you can go back into I'd have to look in my notes, 1900s or 1920s, there was a talk of a sheriff's posse hunting down a wild family. And as you know, in some of the old newspaper accounts, when they would describe a Sasquatch, it was a wild man of the forest that would steal livestock. So, you know, so it's modern folklore, i.e., you know, 20th century. There's folklore of a particular type of white-colored hominid in this area, you know, going back into the 1900s, and then all the way back further than that.
Say, wow, definitely diverse with a bunch of different aspects to it, because you got a little bit of the paranormal, a little bit of cryptid sightings, a little bit of UFOs. So it seems like you have like a perfect pocketed area that you kind of stumbled across seemingly on accident, I assume, right? Because you were originally kind of trying to look for just anything kind of weird in the area. And I'm assuming that you guys started having some of your own experiences. Oh, yeah. And then that's when you guys started really just setting up your base camp there and really using that spot in particular.
Yeah, you know, we started focusing on it, and so we really, you know, we really focused on that one very tight, you know, 7-acre, you know, field. And since then, we've started kind of spreading out regionally, and I say regionally, I don't mean, you know, like 80 miles, I'm talking like maybe 10 miles out in this big wilderness, and we're finding, you know, high strangeness in these places too, you know. So it's one of those things kind of... you know, and people are thinking, well, that sounds like Skinwalker Ranch. It's a lot like the Uinta Basin, is you have, you know, this region of high strangeness, you know, that's well documented, you know, back, you know, centuries.
So without, of course, giving away the name of the location or anything like that, does it fall on any ley lines? You don't have to say specifically which one, but is it one of those things that lines up geographically with like ley lines?
Not so much a ley line. Oh gosh, you're wanting me to go somewhere I don't want to go. Let me say there are geographic markers that seem to have a correlation of high strangeness in other parts of the world. I'll just say that. So, you know, and people are probably thinking, well, you know, why doesn't he just tell people? Why is he being such a butthole about this? Well, it's on public land. You know, it's not private. I can't fence it. You know, I don't own it. I don't know, you know, actual person doesn't own it. It's public land. And anybody who's done any kind of research like this, and you know, you've done Sasquatch research, you know that once in the Yates place was outed, you know, in the Carolinas as a Bigfoot, you know, hot spot. You know, no serious research can be done there now. It's covered up. I know last time I went out there with David Pardue, there were people doing howls and wood knocks, you know, all throughout the forest, and you couldn't tell what was human and what wasn't. It was like a circus.
Yep.
So, you know, that's what I'm trying to avoid, you know. And then if you go and you talk to people like Brandon Fugel, Dwayne Ollinger, which Dwayne and I have talked a bit. Once people learn about places of high strangeness like Blind Frog Ranch or Skinwalker Ranch, is you just have a real security problem, and it's really hard to do serious research, and it can get kind of dangerous because you don't know who's drawn out there. You know, you're out there with, you know, walking around with a pack full of literally thousands of dollars worth of equipment, you know, and you take a risk. So I'm careful about the location. I'm not doing that to be, you know, punitive or mean, but there is a method to my madness.
Oh no, I can definitely understand that. I was going to mention, yeah, even just going for like Squatch hikes and stuff and doing my own paranormal research and stuff. As soon as a location is publicly known, then you, like you said, you can't do any more serious research there because people will step into trace evidence. They'll start trying to stage certain things. They'll start messing with people. Like, it just gets way too muddy. And especially like you said, on public land. No rudeness taken at all. And I'm sure anybody that's an investigator completely understands that once you find a location, especially if you're having as much luck as you are in this particular area, it's like, you don't want anybody to know about it. And I mean, I would even probably have the team sign something to make sure that they didn't accidentally disclose anything too, just to be safe.
We do. The whole team has signed NDAs, any guest researchers, and I have quite a few guests. Researchers come out, they sign NDAs also.
So kind of diving into some of the experiences to kind of lead it away from the location, of course, I know you didn't necessarily want to go down that way. Where did it all kind of start as far as, I know that it's been like a chain of events that have happened at this place since you guys have really started investigating here. I know the UFO type stuff really drew you guys in, but what made you guys really want to like solid plant your roots there? And what kind of anomalies, what kind of events happen in this area?
Yeah, it goes all the way back to 2016. You know, we had that UFO sighting back at base camp, which was just a phenomenal sighting. I mean, it was really, really cool. So that was in January of 2016. So we decided, hey, let's go back, you know, during the summer with a little bit larger crew and, you know, kind of see what could happen. So we went back in July of 2016, and our concept of operations, and I kind of run the things like a military operation, not that we're paramilitary, you know, paramilitary or anything like that. It's just that the run things like that makes a lot of sense. It's very organized. So, you know, we have a, before we go out, we have a briefing on, you know, who's in what team, where the teams are assigned, what your mission is, what your objective is. Here's everybody's radio call signs. Everybody has radio comms back with a net control center back at base camp. We have a scribe back at base camp keeping a radio log of everything that goes on. And so everybody knows exactly what they're doing. So before we ever step foot in the field, we have an idea of how we're going to run, you know, the mission that evening. So that particular night in July, what we were going to do is set up teams around the periphery of the meadow with thermal and night vision. And we were going to have an individual walk along the top of the ridge and see if he could either see anything down below us or down below, or if he could push anything, drive anything down into the open meadow and we could capture it with our equipment. So the individual, we started off, and the individual that was going to run the ridge, he said, wait, I left something back at base camp. Let me go grab it. I will tell you when I'm, you know, ready to start moving across the top of the ridge. So we got set up, and so he radios back, and he says, hey, he goes, I just got to the down tree across the trail, which is a really well-known landmark that everybody on the team knows. And he said, I don't remember how I got here. So Daryl, my paramedic, you know, the first thing he thinks is it's a medical incident. You know, somebody has some sort of, you know, cognitive issue going on that's medically induced. So he gets on the radio and he says, okay, you know, can you feel your extremities? Yeah. Do you feel lightheaded? No. Do you have a headache? No. Repeat, Mary had a little lamb, you know, listening for slurring of speech or missing of words, you know, like a stroke victim would have. Everything worked out okay. He says, I just don't remember getting here. So, you know, we all have a normalcy box. That's where we pull out rationality and we try to throw it at whatever the situation is. So we pulled out that rationality and we said, oh, well, he must have just been really thinking about what the mission was and just, you know, kind of came to out of his daydream at this landmark and radioed it in. So we, you know, kind of minimized it. So he moved across the top of the ridge, dropped down in the east area of the meadow and started working his way west. The entrance of the meadow is on the west. So one team made up of Daryl and Tim. Daryl has a degree in management from Georgia Institute of Technology, has a master's degree in public administration, lifetime career in the emergency medical field. His partner, Tim, has a degree from Georgia Tech in physics and philosophy, served with the 75th Ranger Regiment in their reconnaissance company, special operations guy, and works in artificial intelligence. So that's Tim. So these two guys were one of the teams, solid guys. So they're watching Bob, the team member that ran across the top of the ridge, drop down. They're watching him on their thermal, and they drop their thermal, and where he was standing, they see this orb of light, this bright orb of energy form and move several hundred yards across the meadow and stop and then disappear. So, of course, that got their interest. They quickly bring their thermals up to where the thing disappeared, and we estimated it moved about 23, 24 miles an hour across the field. So they bring their thermals up, and they're watching it, and they see Bob standing there. And they quickly get on their radio, and they say, hey, you know, team, whatever, are you okay? And they're watching through their thermals, and they see this heat signature bring a radio up to its mouth, key the mic, and say, yes, I'm fine. Why? Stay there. We're coming to you. So they went over to him, and they said, what happened? He said, I don't know what you're talking about. I just walked over here. They said, no, you didn't. You turned into a ball of energy and flew across the field. He said, no, I just walked over here. And these two highly educated, rational men said, no, we saw you turn into a ball of energy. the cool thing is they were both right. The observation team and Bob were both right, and they were both wrong, depending on what perspective they look at it from. If so, what you know, I think you might have been experiencing there, we saw there, was something like the dual slit experiment, where light performs both as a wave and a particle at the same time. It has two natures. Is reality had two natures at the same time at that instance. So it was almost like it was a quantum event, but on a macro scale. So obviously when you have that go on, that kind of piqued your interest a little bit. That's kind of weird. So we thought that was, with the missing time, and this orb thing, it's like, okay, yeah, screw that haunted road business. This is where we're going to research. And later that night, Glenn, very, very competent guy, flight medic, got up to take care of some biological business in the middle of the night. And he looks, out to the periphery of the campsite, and he sees the classic tree peeper, looking around, Sasquatch stories are full of these, and then going back. But the interesting thing is this thing was white. And you go back and you dig into the folklore. In the 1900s, there is a folklore of a white hominid in this region. So it lined up perfectly with the folklore that he wasn't aware of. So what he's doing is he's reinforcing folklore and earlier sightings, which turn out weren't folklore. They were legitimate encounters. So the next day, Bob, who had the missing time and the ball of energy, comes back with his GPS. Now, he has a very, very rich history and experience in backcountry search and rescue in California. He was a search and rescue canine handler. They would helicopter him and his dog out to incredibly remote locations. They would find hopefully alive individuals, oftentimes deceased individuals. So he extremely competent outdoorsman. And being so, he always ran the breadcrumb tracking program on his GPS that showed the track, where he would move during each outing. And he showed us that GPS track from the night before. The weird thing is several of the track lines were straight lines. This terrain is so rugged, you can't move in a straight line, either by foot or by car. It also showed him being on the other side of that small river. He was never wet. So how can somebody travel across a river and never get wet, or travel across extremely rugged terrain in a straight line in the air?
I mean, just throwing in just a possible theory, it's something I talked about on a previous show, this whole concept about there being the possibility of like some type of like microscopic wormholes. And it seems like it might be possible in that area, at least. I mean, diving into like portals and everything, everybody kind of has their own different theories on it. But the one that I suggested is that essentially our reality is full of these microscopic wormholes. And the best way to describe it is almost like wiring inside of a wall, that your reality is the inside of the room, but there's still stuff that coordinates and works around the outside and connects this piece to this piece over here. So I've kind of theorized a few times that there might be a possibility of people walking through these microscopic wormholes and not even necessarily realizing it. And it could also potentially be where a lot of this like weird phenomenon comes from, because at least from a lot of the research that I've done pertaining to Sasquatch, it seems like a commonality with a lot of those people that start to investigate the woo side of it is usually seeing like blue orbs around Sasquatch. And talking to another it was a previous guest. He was somewhat of an astrophysicist. He was suggesting the idea about, in order for something to be able to travel through a portal or a wormhole, that it would have to condense into a different form of matter in order to make it through to the other side. So I kind of started throwing the idea about like orbs possibly being related to being able to travel through these wormholes. And he was saying that he believes that theory is definitely possible. So it seems like, especially in the area that you guys were researching, it kind of falls into the idea about there being the possibility of these microscopic wormholes all over our universe, and we might transverse through them and not even realize it half the time because we're still seeing it through our perspective. But from another perspective, like you were saying, it is a totally different phenomenon that's happening.
How about this? We captured one of those on film.
Ooh, even better.
Yeah. I was in 2017 the next time we went out. So this was February of 2017. We decided to start trying to do some research during the winter months because you have a lack of vegetation. You know, you can see further with your thermals. You can see further with the naked eye. And quite frankly, your odds of running into somebody is a lot less likely, you know, because people just aren't going to go out in the woods in February when it's really cold. So, you know, we went back in February of 2017 and we made a decision that nobody would ever go out by themselves. You know, since the missing time and the ball of energy thing, that you would always have a team of at least two people, one of which as a minimum would have radio communications back with base camp. That was a safety thing. So we went back with a kind of a new concept of operation as far as safety goes, but kind of the same basic outline is we set up several teams in the meadow, and we were going to have a three-person team run across the ridge from the south, since that seemed to do something last time, and see if we could have any kind of event happen. So I was on the team that was on top of the ridge, and you know, we moved across the top of the ridge. And we were looking down into the field with our thermals, and we would see deer, various wildlife, and they were very, very stark, on the thermals. You could tell exactly what they were. There was no question on what these creatures were. And so we had seen some deer down in the other meadow, and then they were gone. You know, we assumed they had just wandered off. And then we looked through our thermals, and we saw something a little bit different. And it was a man-sized, I'm not going to say man-shaped, I'm going to say man-sized heat signature, about a meter and a half wide, about 2 meters tall. So that's about 18 or some odd inches, 20-something inches wide, about 6 foot tall, standing vertical. And then this heat signature gets small, gets big, gets small, gets big, and then splits into two. And then disappears. So it's like, okay, now you have our interest. So, we scanned around looking for, any other heat signature. We double checked with any of the field teams to see if they had moved off station. That's why it's really important to know where everybody is. So you're not going to confuse a team for something anomalous. No teams had moved off station. No team were in the area where we saw this thing. So we drop into the meadow and we start moving to the east. One of my team members got on the radio and he said, "Hey, we keep seeing on thermal this box or cube. And it's about 30 feet by 20 feet by 20 feet. And we'll see it in one part of the meadow and it'll dissipate. And it'll pop up in another part of the meadow and dissipate and then pop up somewhere else." So this cube, which is interesting because you look at a lot of your UFO sightings, they involve cubes or cube-like structures or box-like structures. So we decide we're going to go over to that team, discuss this with them, and we get over there, and about the time we get there, they say, "We just had one, and it's starting to fade away." And you can just barely see the remnants of it on their thermal. So we decided we would dispatch a team to where this thing was. And one of the teams was a two-person team, and they go over to where this object was. And so we're watching them through thermal. Now, remember, this is February in the mountains. It's very cold. So there's a very stark difference between the heat signature of a human being and the ambient environmental temperature. So, your ambient temperature is much, much colder than the human being. So we're watching them through our thermals, and when they get to the edge of where this thing was, they disappear. Their heat signature is gone, like obliterated. And they described it when they walked in there that they walked freely and easily into this area. They didn't run into any briars or anything. They just walked into it, and it was colder inside of this thing. And it was very dark. It was like they were inside of a blackout curtain. They stayed there for about 60 seconds, turned around and came out. Now, when they came out, they started running into briars and branches and things that made it kind of difficult for them to work their way back out of it. What's odd is, not only did they disappear off of thermal, the environment changed from the time they went in there to the time they came back out, the physical environment. So once again, it's like you had two realities occupying the same space at almost the same time. We have gone back and tried to recreate the obscurance of their heat signatures. And we went back to the same place with both a regular video camera and a thermal camera and had people walk during the daytime through this area to see if there's anything that would completely obscure their heat signature. We did it at the same time of year. And while they would be partially obscured, they were never totally obscured. Now, this is the heat signature of not one person, but two people, completely obscured. And then they had the experiential stuff go along with it. So we were able to capture that on film. And hopefully soon, and I can't really go into it, but hopefully sometime in the near future, people will get to see that on a much larger scale.
Say, I would absolutely love to be able to see that when you actually do end up releasing that. We will be right back after this brief commercial break, so stay tuned. And we are back, so let's hop right in. So you're kind of theorizing that that could possibly be a portal opening, or have you taken into consideration the fact that it could possibly be some type of like micro universe?
Well, you know, portal, you know, is kind of a loaded term, you know, and what I, you know, use that label is, it is a doorway to something that isn't here, you know, that, to an environment that's not this environment, you know. So is it, you know, a time slip? Is it, you know, a dimensional slip? Is it a, you know, some sort of other anomaly, you know, with our three-dimensional reality? But it is a doorway or a path to something that is different. And so luckily we were able to, you know, we had the equipment and the team experienced, our researchers on site, they're actually able to film this. So it's, you know, it's really a really an amazing, you know, piece of evidence.
So you guys will have to try to figure out if there's some type of like rhyme or reasoning to it, because part of like what I was talking about with my, whole or wormhole theory was the idea that I think it might be possible that certain places open up at certain times. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if that's necessarily like time itself, because obviously time is not linear and doesn't necessarily work the same way in other dimensions, or if it's more so possibly just the ability of the planet being lined up with a particular like point in space as we're like rotating, as we're evolving or revolving around the sun. Maybe it's just like a specific area, place that everything sits. And then when that opening ends up happening is when these weird beings, these weird anomalous events start happening. And I mean, that could possibly be when you have like Sasquatch or UFOs or whatever they come through, because they essentially wait and know when this opening is going to happen. And then they take advantage of coming in, and either one, they end up going back before it closes, or two, they might be stuck here until that opens back up again.
Or they have a mission here that they haven't completed. They'll complete their mission and then go.
Yep, exactly. But this thing was like completely, like perfectly, like cube shaped. Just out of curiosity, or was it more like a square when you guys were looking at it?
It was. Imagine, you know, like I said, the dimensions were 10 meters by 6 meters by 6 meters. So it was like a rectangle. You know, it wasn't exactly perfectly cube shaped. It was a little longer, you know, than it was wide.
And
imagine like a really big shoebox, you know, about that type of configuration, except it didn't have sneakers in it.
And I mean, part of the other theory that I mentioned that kind of lines up with also what you were saying too, is that assumably when there is some type of opening, be it, you want to call it a wormhole, a portal, or an opening into somewhere else, assumably there would be some type of positive, negative pressure change happening from that area that would either cause anomalous weather, or it might cause drastic temperature change. But it seems like it lines up kind of with what I was saying, or with what I was saying versus what you were saying too. And it seems like a lot of the time when people find in these like weird locations, like it kind of seems to be a common trope with a lot of like UFO sightings, for example, is that when people are in the middle of the woods, they're walking, they have a sighting, they end up experiencing time loss with it. Mm-hmm. They usually end up reporting some type of like weird weather change that happens with that too, which kind of links the whole idea of what we're kind of saying in the beginning of the show, that a lot of this stuff, I believe, like kind of links over itself more than that people actually realize. And that's where a lot of people get stuck with their work, is that they're just looking for UFOs or just cryptids or just the paranormal, when it all kind of lines up together, or might be using the same opportunity to get here. I mean, maybe they may not be related themselves individually, but they might be using the same opportunities to get into our reality. So that's kind of where the overlay might happen with these things.
Yeah. It's, you hit on an interesting point is, if it's a natural phenomena, you know, civilizations have harnessed natural phenomena for their own use, you know, forever. Wind. You know, we sailed on sailing ships using a natural phenomena of wind, and empires were built on that. You know, civilizations were looted, i.e. the Mayans and the Aztecs were looted because of wind technology. So that's a very interesting point. And, you know, kind of using my background as an analyst, you know, as a military intelligence guy, is I'm looking for indicators. You know, I'm looking for telltale signs. And one of the things that we have since discovered is micro variations in radiation. Is now we take Geiger counters out in the field with us. And so in this particular location and other areas in that region where we've had incidences of high strangeness, two really cool ones come to mind with radiation, is you'll see a spike in radiation. And the background radiation in that area is about 0.0, I'd say 5 or 6 microsieverts per hour. And in two instances, we've seen spikes of 0.33 microsieverts per hour, and then one incidence of a spike of 0.66 microsieverts per hour. And I'll tell you about those incidents. The first one was we had gone back to the meadow, and unfortunately, our team members are passing away. People that have had these experiences are passing away on my team. So Tim, the gentleman I talked about, the Army Ranger, who was one of the ones that went into the portal, died. And so we had gathered in 2021, let me back up, 2020, to kind of memorialize them. And so it was kind of a quiet, you know, somber gathering, but one of my research partners and I, Kristen, decided we would go out to the meadow and we would, you know, kind of see what was going on out there. We'd take some baselines, radiation baselines. We would double check, take GPS coordinates of where all these strange things happened. And we decided we were going to cross across that small river, you know, to the north. And so a little bit of my background is I'm an Eagle Scout, former Army officer, backpacked all over the U.S. I've hunted big game in Africa, traveled the world, been on every continent except two. So I'm very comfortable taking care of myself. I'm very comfortable in the woods. You know, that's not a problem. I'm not a flighty, you know, person that goes out in the woods all kind of spooky and skittish. I'm very comfortable there. And this is a location we've been to probably by that time 40 times in the meadow. So we cross over this small river. I get to the other side of it. And I was amazed. On the other side of this river was another big field, you know, like a big opening. And I thought, this is really cool. We can run concurrent investigations on both sides of this little river, you know, and have radio comms back and forth. And it's, you know, it just really opens up our ability to do more research. And so I could hear Kristen working her way across the river. And I said, hey, Kristen, wait until you get over here. There's another meadow over here. There's another big field. And she goes, what are you talking about? And I said, oh, it's really cool. You know, wait until you get here. And she goes, don't move. You know, I'm coming to you. So I'm looking around. I'm like, oh, I've never seen this before. This is really cool. She gets over to me and she says, Trey, what are you talking about? And I said, this new field, look at it. Isn't this neat? You know, we can do two investigations, two research parties can be, you know, in these two different locations at the same time. She goes, you're right where we started. You never made it to the other side. And I shook my head and I said, no. Listen to me. And she goes, no, really. Look around you. This is the meadow. And this is hard to articulate. But when I started looking around with the insistence of her that this was where we started, it changed. It morphed back into the meadow. And that sounds goofy and crazy. That's my personal perception of it. You know, take that as it is.
Was it like mirrored possibly? Like from your perspective?
It's hard to articulate. It was just different. You know, it was so different that I didn't recognize it. And where it gets weird is that the moment that was going on, the data logger on the Geiger counter recorded a 0.33 microsievert spike in radiation. So I'm sure you've heard of a gentleman by the name of David Pilates.
Yeah, of course, with missing 411.
There you go. You know, if I hadn't had another research partner with me, could I have been a chapter in one of his new books?
Do you think that the river itself might have something to do with it? Because I know with a lot of the missing 411 stuff, on my other show, we just recently did an episode on it, and we're kind of theorizing about different things that may have happened. And I've kind of dug into somewhat of a portal theory pertaining to the fact of there being magnetized volcanic rock that was left from some period in time and having some type of stone that ends up being a battery for this to happen. So you end up having magnetic, usually tunnels, and then you'll have some type of like quartz, for example, on top. And then when you add a vibration or a hum to it, that's when you potentially are able to open some stuff up. But, I mean, there's also the whole thing that has to do with water, where a lot of these weird creatures, especially, I know that like Spearfinger was always known to say that she kind of followed the rivers and stayed along water. So you hear about this, like this energy change with water, and that it's, you know, it's obviously a conductor and everything, kind of expanding past to other possibilities of how these things could possibly open.
Yeah.
Do you think the river itself might be where there's like a veil or a wall or something that you're never really intended to ever really see the other side because there's almost like a wall there?
You know, that's an interesting point. You know, unfortunately, you know, if people think you go into this business finding answers, not only do you find out you don't know what the answers are, you don't even really know what the questions are. I don't know. It's really weird because you start laying some other instances on top of this. That location was only about 30 meters from where the cube was. So it was in the same location. And to make things even stranger, and I'm going to see if I can get this photograph pulled up for y'all, is back in, no, I don't have it with me. Well, maybe I can pull it up in my book here. Is we found in that small river, that small creek, literally in the middle of it was a sapling that was like tied into an oval, and it was about 12 feet up in the air. It was maybe about an inch in diameter, inch and a half in diameter, on the middle of a very small island in the middle of this creek. Now, where it gets interesting is you couldn't get up there to it. There was no way to get to this thing and tie it into an oval. And let's see. Here it is. Let's see if I can. I don't know if y'all can see that oval kind of right.
Yeah, there. I can see it.
Okay. So that oval was tied into a sapling up in the top of this, or the sapling was tied into an oval in the middle of the creek, right where I crossed. This was a different time, of course. If you go and you start researching symbology, the oval is oftentimes referred to as something called the galactic keyhole. Okay, it's the same thing you see on the top of an Egyptian ankh. It's also something you see in places that have a reputation of being gateways or doorways. So it's very interesting that we found that oval at the same place where I crossed the creek which is only a few meters from where this box or portal formed.
Do you think that there may have been something that physically did that, possibly as like a marker of where this thing is at? Or do you think it's some type of like weird anomaly that happens around some of these weird locations that the plant maybe just grows weird because of the different energy and different frequencies and everything kind of happening in the area?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question. You know, once again, who knows? You know, folks in the Sasquatch world talk about markers, you know, and we've seen them, oh gosh, as recently as, I'm trying to remember, September, I think it was, a few months ago, we found a tree broken at a perfect 90 degrees, about 12 feet up in the air, broken across like this. So, you know, in Sasquology, or whatever you want to call it, you know, markers, wood markers are very, very prevalent. Same thing with, you know, human beings is, you know, here in the South is trail trees are very common where trees are broken over, you know, in antiquity to mark a trail and they grow up. You'll go in the woods and you'll see these trees with a 90 degree break in them where they weren't, were broken over as a marker for a trail. So, you know, whether or not an intelligence knew that there was something special or sacred about that spot and made some sort of effigy to either mark it or memorialize it, or if it was something natural, you know, I can't really say.
And then just out of curiosity, after that experience, have you had, just at least yourself, not necessarily everybody on the team, but you yourself, have you had any other like time loss experiences or had a time loss experience and then had some type of a bizarre sighting afterwards?
Not so much time loss. What's happening is the phenomena is evolving. And here I'm going to take it, like if we aren't already in the woo enough, I'm going to step into the woo even further, is mind speak or mind communication. And what we're having is really interesting things happen at night during dreams. And we're also now having instances of precognition. Is, and let me get my notes here, is in June 20th, and in January 20th is when I had that really bad disorientation there at the creek, the river. In June 20th, we went back out, and we had a couple of really weird things happen. And this is the second weird weekend with a weird radiation spike, and then something I think is even more interesting, is we started having, that was right during COVID, and the campsite that we usually stayed at was closed off by the governmental entity that runs this. They didn't want people camping and spreading COVID. You just remember how crazy it was back then. Nobody knew really how you contracted it. So, but they still allowed dispersed camping. So there was a place that was used by hunters, which was about 4 miles away from the meadow. So we decided we would set up base camp there. So we all met there. And we started having our vehicles lock and unlock themselves. Like people would have their key fobs in their tents and the vehicles would just lock and unlock themselves, arm and disarm their theft deterrent systems. So we had this like weird stuff going on electronically with the vehicles. So that night we decided we were going to try something a little bit different. We all got in our cars and we convoyed down to the meadow and we hiked, you know, 3/4 of a mile back to the meadow and we were going to do a CE5 session. And you're familiar with the CE5 protocol developed by Dr. Stephen Greer for UFOs?
Yeah, of course. Just for the sake of the listeners, they may not be familiar too, just if you want to kind of give like a quick explanation too, just so that they're not lost.
It's basically where people will gather, you know, in an open area and they will project intent to communicate with UAPs or UFOs or whatever and try to bring them in. And there's some people use radar detectors to send signals out or use it as a means of detecting if something is coming in. Some people will use flashing lights. Some people will use crop circle tones. So we use the crop circle tones and we sat around and we projected intention, watched the skies, didn't really see a whole lot. We ended up just sort of sitting around and joking and, you know, making off color jokes and, you know, just enjoying each other's company. While we were doing that, we had an individual watching base camp and we violated our rule. We left somebody at base camp by themselves, which we shouldn't have done. This campsite was probably about 30 yards off of a dirt county road in the middle of the forest. Well, our base camp guy was sitting there, and he heard something coming, like that distinctive gravel crunch of a vehicle going down a chert or gravel road. So he quickly turned off his lantern, blacked out the camp, and he sat there. And the sound passed by the campsite down the road. He never saw any lights. He never saw any vehicle. And I will use the word craft, because it was a craft of some kind passed by the base camp. And when this thing passed by the base camp, his Geiger counter spiked up to 0.66 microsieverts per hour.
Which, for anybody that may not be familiar, just something I want to throw in real quick, a lot of UFO stuff does give off radiation. So yeah, just there's the connecting factor for anybody that may not have put two and two together.
Gary Nolan's done research on that. DIA has several reports on that, on pilots that have encountered stuff with radiation burns, things like that.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. And we are back, so let's hop right in.
So where it gets even weirder is we did hypnotic regression with this individual. And we asked him about that. Our psychotherapist is also a certified hypnotherapist. And he said, at first, I couldn't see anything. It was dark. It was black. I couldn't see anything. It was invisible. And then he said, oh, it was a Jeep with the top down. And it's like, okay, so who was driving the Jeep? Oh, it had two occupants in it. We'll describe the occupants. They were all black. They had black faces, black heads, black hands, black arms, black feet, like black shadows in the Jeep. It stopped. One got out, walked around, got back in, and continued on. Now, unfortunately, that individual passed away, and we were not able to dig down into that regression more. But a lot of times people doing their first regression that have had amazing UFO experiences, they'll have a memory, you know, where their mind remembers things in a certain way, and they try to categorize it in something that fits their understanding of reality.
The screen memories.
And they're called screen memories.
Yep.
And, you know, I talked to the hypnotherapist after that, and I said, do you think that was a screen memory? Because the occupants do not sound like humans. And at first he said that the craft was invisible, and then he said it was a Jeep, but he couldn't see it. He goes, yeah, that sounds like a screen memory. There was something else there. So we have that going on back at base camp while we're out there goofing around trying to make the CE5 protocol work. So we come back to camp. He tells us about this. It's like, wow, that's really cool. Amazing. We all go to bed. The next morning, we're packing up, getting ready to come home. And one of my team members, a gentleman by the name of Tony S., graduated the U.S. Air Force Academy, has a degree in engineering, did Air Force Special Operations for a while. Now is an expert in his field, travels all over the world, a subject matter expert, you know, that kind of guy, squared away guy. He said at 0430, he goes, I woke up from a dead sleep, and he was out there with the CE5 with us. And he said, I had two words that popped into my head. And the words were Nox Magbe, N-O-X-M-A-G-B-E-E, phonetically spelled. Nox Magbe. Does that mean anything to you? And I said, no, I'll look it up, though. So I got back and I started researching that. And he said, also, I woke up again at 6:30, same words in my head. So I looked it up. Nox, N-O-X, turns out to be the Roman goddess of the night, which was derived from the Greek goddess Nyx, N-Y-X. Magbe turned out to be a little more difficult. So I actually started scouring, you know, different text, and I went back to Beowulf, the old English poem Beowulf, and there's a word in there called Magba, which means kindred or children. And as the Romans left Britain, and Old English quickly became the language, and that culture started developing there in the Dark Ages, is the people that spoke that language would also have some knowledge of the Roman belief system. So what I'm getting at is the term Nox and Magba can possibly be contemporaneous. so existed at the same time. So you put those together, okay? And so you have children, night goddess. Children of the night goddess are kindred of the night goddess. So what are small, like children, with big heads like children, that come to visit you at night?
The Greys.
Whitley yep. Strieber has one on the cover of his book, Communion. We were asking for contact. Perhaps we got it.
See, I was even kind of wondering if it was possible that that experience may have been some type of like Men in Black. And the Men in Black, of course, you know, you don't know if they're necessarily extraterrestrial related or if they're possibly human related or some kind of weird thing on the in-between. But that would almost kind of fit the idea of, you know, there being two things wearing all black within the Jeep. They could potentially even have the ability to try to leave screen memories on people if they're just trying to kind of check out an area and not actually be seen and start trying to intimidate the person that they're dealing with. And then the other follow-up I was going to ask, just out of curiosity, is if you guys have received any like random phone calls, any government intervention of any means, or seemingly government intervention. Like, I'm kind of curious if there's other beings, otherworldly forces, or even possibly like agents themselves, like kind of keeping an eye on you guys that might already be somewhat aware of what happens in this area.
Well, up until recently, I was the government with a top
true.
Team, keeping an eye on myself. No, not really. Not so much. Which is very interesting because kind of going down that line of questioning is I worked on. I'll say projects. That's all I'll say. Professionally, I worked on projects, and some of those projects had direct support from counterintelligence agencies, and I had agents I would work with on these projects. So to give you an idea of the governmental interest in this thing, one of the agents that I worked with, was asking me about, stuff, and I told him, I said, I wrote a book on it, and the sole interest by this agency's counterintelligence special agents, where they wanted an autographed copy of the book. So, if they were going to, keep an eye on us, they could have brought me into, if it was a governmental thing, they could have read me into that program, sworn me to secrecy on the inside of it, and worked with me from there, from that side of it. And that never happened.
I guess that still leaves the possibility of the
government security guy. So that's what you would want us to believe. Ha ha ha. So, you just have to take my word for that.
I guess there's still definitely the possibility of there being the woo-woo side of the Men in Black, possibly.
Yeah. And it was it's really weird because we've even gone as far as to say, okay, so this thing was invisible. You couldn't see it at night. We've gone as far as doing experiments with mounting infrared lights on vehicles and driving down that road at night with night vision to see how hard it is to drive a blacked out vehicle. And it's not as easy as one would think. So, statistically, what are the odds of, some hillbilly having, a Jeep equipped with, IR illuminators and Gen 3 military night vision tootling around the forest, in the dark? I don't know. That seems a bit extreme to me, but who knows?
And I mean, at least digging into like the Greys and stuff possibly being in that area, I mean, that still kind of lends credence into the whole aspect of there being, again, some type of like portal or opening. And it's almost like direct communication with these things. And I mean, they might have more of an understanding of what's happening in the area in the first place. And in turn, they might also be kind of trying to keep an eye on you guys to see if you guys figure it out, because maybe they want you to figure it out. Maybe they don't want you to figure it out, but regardless, if they on the other side know that there's something weird and anomalous in the area, their whatever version of the government / people in charge might want to keep tabs on what you guys are doing and not be seen keeping tabs on you guys, because they don't want to hint that there is something weird happening in the area. They want you kind of just to leave it alone.
Yeah, kind of along those lines, something that I totally forgot to mention is when the box or the portal was opening, is we have video of one of our thermal operators swinging to the right saying, "Who or what are those?" And in a small copse of trees, a little tiny grouping of trees, there's two upright heat signatures watching us that did not correspond with any team members, which was the same night that we saw the strange heat signature from the top of the ridge.
Just out of curiosity, because I know you kind of get into like the woo-woo aspect of things, have you ever had anybody possibly try to like astral project in this area? Like somebody that you have on the investigation physically in the area that's tried to astral project to see if they get a different perspective on what's happening in the area?
Strangely enough, most of our team members are trained remote viewers.
Oh, perfect.
Trained in actual military stock coordinate remote viewing. So yeah, we have.
Just out of curiosity, did they see anything different? Does it like look exactly the same? Like what was kind of like their perspective while doing remote viewing?
Nothing I'm comfortable with discussing right now. I'll just say that.
So interesting, but can't be discussed yet.
You know, it's not entirely conclusive. You know, remote viewing is a really tricky art. So, you know, there's some interesting things that have come out of those remote viewing sessions. Nothing I really, you know, would feel comfortable speculating on. I'll just say that. And it's not because I'm being elusive. I just, you know, nothing concrete that I would necessarily want to throw out there.
Oh, yeah, completely understandable. And just out of curiosity, of course, I want to be able to dive into your book a little bit so that you can kind of promote your book a little bit and people can come and check it out. But before we kind of start wrapping up and getting into that aspect of it, is there any other experiences, weird anomalous events, anything else that you'd kind of like to share with the audience as far as this area goes?
Oh, gosh, tons. We haven't even scratched the surface of it yet. I mean, we've had everything from just weird stuff. Now people are being touched, physically being touched by unseen forces. You know, we had a female team member grabbed while she was sitting in her camp chair, but nothing was around her. We had another team member, not a team member, a guest researcher, pretty well-known person. Her traveling companion had his hoodie tugged on. So, you know, now it's like becoming... And if you read like Keller and Knapp's book, The Hunt for the Skinwalker, and some of that stuff, there's a very strong paranormal aspect to this stuff, or what we label paranormal. So these are almost like when people talk about being touched by ghosts, now we've got that kind of stuff going on. It's evolved into you know, more dream speak. We've done SD sessions and have, we believe, communicated with, you know, an entity, you know, and the transcript of that's in the book. We've have shadow people sightings. We had a documentary film crew out with us back in, let's see, October of 2022. The production assistant and cinematographer got so scared that they will never come back. The director talked to him and he said, no, they'll never come back here. He says, if we're ever going to film here again, he said, it's going to be you and I, you know, me running the camera and you being my assistant, because they won't come back out here. So, you know, shadow people, UFO sight, more UFO sightings, SD sessions, precognition. We've had somebody have a precognitive feeling of something slinking across the meadow. Friday night, Saturday night, there was a creature slinking across the meadow. Unfortunately, my thermal operator rationalized it into being a bear or a feral hog. And I said, why would a bear or a feral hog walk into a giant opening with 12 people surrounding it? An animal wouldn't do that. And he's like, holy crap, you're right. You go back to Skinwalker Ranch and them talking about the creature slinking out of the portal. So, yeah, just tons of weird stuff. And the neat thing is there's more to come. You know, we're still out there researching this place. You're still planning expeditions, you know, looking at different technologies, different ways of, you know, maybe doing some experiments. We're doing some work now with something called a God helmet or Corrin helmet, where before we go out there, we'll take certain team members and we'll electromagnetically stimulate their amygdala and hippocampus. Hopefully make them more receptive to the woo. You know, there's been some really interesting studies on that done by Dr. Robert Persinger. And I just recently purchased a time time dispersion meter probe. So it has a base unit and a probe out at 100 feet, you know, about 30 meters. And it'll tell you if time is running different in these 2 points. So, you know, we're looking at it from a lot of different aspects.
That was one thing I was going to ask, too, is if you guys have tried anything as far as, like, watches go, where when people experience the, like, time warp or, like, when they jump ahead, if their watch changes time than everybody else's watch does.
Yeah, we have. You know, we've done, we've taken stopwatches, had one at base camp in a sealed metal box as a Faraday cage, put another one out there in the meadow in a sealed cage, sealed box. And what we found out is the stopwatches, you know, we're privately funded, you know, so you know, all of this stuff comes out of our pocket. You know, when you start dropping $3,000 and $4,000 on thermals and other stuff, it runs out pretty quick. Mm-hmm. So we just don't have the time, time pieces that are accurate enough and run long enough to really try that. So this time displacement meter, I'm not going to say is reasonable, but it's, you know, it's a little bit more reasonable than two super highly calculated and calibrated clocks. So, you know, we're trying different things, but a lot of our team now have gone, like, I wear an analog mechanical watch now. I don't wear an electronic watch anymore.
That's what I was going to say. The hard part now is that everybody wears a digital or a smartwatch. Yeah. So it's like, it's hard to find the analogs where you can actually just have the straight gears and actually kind of get an idea of if things are changing. Because no matter what with the smartwatches, it'll switch back to the time it's supposed to be regardless before you even get to check it out.
Yeah. We had the, you know, the cinematographer, when he was out there filming, there was one area in the meadow, about an 18-foot kind of circle thing. He would step into that circle, his battery would drop down to 20%. He'd step back out of it, it'd go up to 80, step back in it, it'd drop to 20, step out of it, it'd go up to 80. So there's like an energy sink, you know, at certain places at certain times in this place.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. And we are back. So let's hop right in.
And you said that the phenomenon has changed through you guys investigating this place. Does it seem like it's gotten like more aggressive, or does it seem like it almost kind of has an interest in like what you guys are doing? Like what's kind of your idea of it?
It's much more organic. It's much more interpersonal now. You know, when people are getting visions in their dreams, people are being touched, not in an aggressive way. You know, and there's some hitchhiker effects going on. Nothing scary, you know, just things that you would notice. And then some of the more interesting hitchhiker effects that people have reported. Strangely is Keller and Knapp talk about giant canines, you know, being sighted, you know, when people, you know, come home for the ranch.
Are you talking about four-legged or like the two-legged canines?
They say two-legged and four-legged, which is interesting is because literally 4 days ago, I found a canine track 40 yards from my back door that was 6 inches in diameter.
Do you live reasonably close to this area, or do you think that the anomaly is starting to almost like follow you guys home more besides just like the typical like attachment hitchhiker effect?
I don't think we live close to the place, but when Keller and Knapp talk about, you know, interviewing some of the NIDS people, National Institute for Discovery Science, founded by Bigelow, they would talk about this stuff following them home, you know, like back to Virginia. And let's see, see if I can pull up a picture of that print. Yeah, so yes, it does follow you home. It's nothing scary, you know. Now, I'm not the kind of guy that's super, you know, skittish anyway, but you know, it's, there we go. See if y'all can see that. That's that rule is 6 inches.
Oh wow.
Yeah, it was a huge, huge print. So, you know, that's the kind of stuff that's going on as recently as a few days ago.
Say, and if you said it's constantly changing, I'll have to have you come back on every couple months if you're interested and kind of give some updates, because I'm absolutely fascinated with this area. And me diving into a lot of my research, a lot of this kind of crosses it. So I'm fascinated to see what else ends up happening with this place.
Yeah, the good news is, you know, like I said, I've already have one book out there. I'm currently working on book number two. Which is going to go into a lot of kind of interesting directions that I think, you know, maybe might answer some questions, but most undoubtedly will create many, many more.
And I guess just kind of a, you kind of, we've been talking about a little bit throughout the show as far as like what you find in the book, but just to kind of push people towards the book, give it a little bit of a quick promotion and a promotion for your upcoming one, if you kind of have like a time idea of when it's coming out. If people decided that they want to come and pick up this book for themselves, do you want to kind of give them like a, just a kind of a quick run over of what they're going to find in it, where they can find it, and, you know, when they might be able to find the second one?
Yeah, The Meadow Project, Explorations into the South's Skinwalker Ranch. The easiest way to find it is just go to Amazon and type in my name, Trey Hudson, and it'll pop up. It's an ebook, hardcover, both softcover and hardback. It's also an audiobook. And if you parlez-vous français, it's in French. So, you know, it's over there on the continent being enjoyed by folks over there. The second book, you sound like my publisher. He's like, okay, when's it coming out? You know, I'm definitely publishing it. When's it coming out? So I am probably about halfway through it. And I am a lazy writer. I hate to say it. I have to make myself write. So, you know, between projects for the wife, you know, I sit down and try to spend about an hour or two a day you know, hacking away on it. So I'm hoping it'll be done, you know, maybe by the latter part of this year. So keep my fingers crossed.
Sounds like people just have to make sure they follow you on social media in order to keep tabs on one that's going to come out.
Yeah, on social media, Trey Hudson-author on Facebook. My webpage is www.treyhudsonresearch.com.
And, of course, I will make sure I put all of those down in the show description so everybody can find everything quick and easy. And before we start wrapping up, at least for today, because like I said, I'd love to have you back on in the future, I always like to close things out with words of wisdom. So if there's any words of wisdom you could bestow on the listeners, possibly some of the investigators out there, whoever you want to direct it towards, what are some words of wisdom you'd like to bestow on the listeners?
Yeah, what I tell people is these areas of high strangeness, they could be in your very own backyard. So get off your couch, put down your cell phone, do the research, put your boots on, and go out into the world and discover these places for yourself and have your own adventures.
That's the only way you can ever create your own framework of having all of these different ideas is if you actually physically go out and investigate and research it yourself. Because anybody can sit on the internet, look stuff up, and kind of have their perception changed by a bunch of these different ideas. But you'll never have that solid, full belief, faith in something until you're actually out there experiencing it yourself. And that's one thing I even learned quick as far as like Sasquatch research goes. But I appreciate you making the time to come on today. Really looking forward to next time. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I'm absolutely fascinated with your research. So, again, thank you for making the time to come on, and I'm really looking forward to next time.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
If you guys enjoyed this episode, don't forget to leave a review or rating for the show on iTunes or Spotify. Definitely have a lot on Spotify. Looking for hopefully some more 5-star reviews as far as the iTunes aspect of things go. And if you guys leave an awesome 5-star review, then of course I'll read on the show and give you guys a big shout out. And the more that you guys leave reviews and keep sharing the show and everything, the more the show will be able to grow, the more the algorithms will push it up towards the top, which means there will be more guests that will be available to come on the show. So the only way the show is going to keep expanding from this point is with your guys' help. So anything that you guys do, I greatly, greatly appreciate. And if anybody wants to get a hold of me for any reason whatsoever, be it that you want to share some fan art, you want to have a conversation, you want to be a guest on the show, you possibly want to have me as a guest on your show sharing some of my experiences, or you want to sponsor the show, anything like that, you guys can get a hold of me through email, which is inquiriesofallrealitypodcast@outlook.com, or you guys can get a hold of me on social media. Instagram is the one that I'm the most active on. Or you guys can go to the link tree, fill the submission form, and that will go directly to my email, of course. I do respond to every single message that I get from you guys, so make sure you guys check the spam and junk folders, make sure nothing gets missed in the process, because, you know, running a podcast, sending out links, a lot of the time it'll flag me as spam, so just make sure you guys keep an eye over there if you guys do send me a message, of course. And everything that I mentioned throughout the entire show is all available down in the show description. And with that, hope you guys enjoyed the conversation, and I'll catch you on the next one. Have a good night, everybody.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.